This is an LACTO Forum production.
Welcome to Exception Handlers, the podcast where CTOs debug the challenges that keep us up at night. I'm Alex.
And I'm Bill.
And on today's episode, we are delighted to have Pavini Saneji, who is the CTO at SmithRx and an executive coach. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Alex and Bill. It's great to be here.
And it's great to have you here. And so I want to have a conversation today. We want to have a conversation today about the impact of AI on companies. And to kind of frame this, I want to maybe offer maybe controversial, maybe not opinion. We'll see. We'll find out. But my controversial take, as I've been seeing sort of the whole thing evolve right in front of our eyes over the last few months, really not years, months. What I'm noticing is the impact of AI is almost inversely proportional to the size of the organization. So I think small startups can get tons of value and have a huge impact from AI. Larger companies get marginal impact at best. And my kind of inkling of a theory here is it has to do with productivity. Individual productivity is almost always the rate limiter on startups and almost never the rate limiter on large companies. Communication overhead and all the rest of it is the rate limiter on large companies. So the conversation we want to have today is, what do we do about that? Is that true? What are we seeing as far as best practices? And is this kind of a natural law of AI, or can it be exceeded with some elbow grease? So that's kind of where we want to start. And just to get into it, I guess, from your perspective, how are you seeing this in terms of AI's impact on the orgs and correlation to size or anything else?
No, Alex, I think what you mentioned is so true that while the potential impact of AI is inversely proportional to the company size, what that warrants is the investment required to unlock that impact is directly proportional to its size. And I think that's what sometimes, you know, leaders overlook or underestimate the importance of that investment. And a couple of things you mentioned, right, as to why it takes longer or why the impact takes a longer time. One is directly the tax of scale. Large companies, the size dictates additional investment in what you mentioned, communication, tooling, processes. And the second one is the nimbleness penalty, which is the size naturally creates that drag, lengthening the turnaround time for an entire workforce to adopt change. But there is anomalies, the company culture exception. There are companies who have invested in the company OS, the personality of the company, the culture of the company. In those companies, even though they are large, we have seen the autonomy and the processes and tooling help them to turn around quickly and drive these adoptions of change much faster.
So and I actually really want to get into that, but I just also want to say, I feel like there's kind of two ways at which you look at this whole AI thing. One is adoption. So how often are we using it? How much of our work is being impacted? And the other is like results. Is anybody's revenue going up because of it? Is anybody's bottom line improving? And I also want to kind of put some context on that. That's independent of cost. But once you start taking AI cost into account, that further makes an interesting picture, right? Bill.
Yeah, and I think there's actually a third leg to that, and that is risk. As the surface of AI output gets larger and larger, the opportunities for bad things to happen, as we've seen with some very large examples of, increases dramatically. So it's not just a productivity thing. There are CISOs around the world right now sweating at night trying to figure out how they're going to keep control of this.
Yeah. And so maybe we can talk through kind of all of those aspects, sort of starting with the easiest, which is, I mean, as crazy as this to say, adoption, right? Like getting people to actually use it, I feel like, is the easiest of the three challenges, but even that could be problematic. So from your experience, what have you seen in organizations that like makes adoption, just the usage of AI, more palatable, easier?
Yeah, I think this is where going back to, you know, the past patterns, when leaders are driving change, what becomes important is to be proactive and intentional about it. You can't think of it that, okay, you know, everyone in the company understands AI change is happening and they will go by doing it. As a leader, you need to be more kind of, you know, strategic about it. And for that, communication becomes the first thing, like you becoming the chief repetition officer to go on articulating that, you know, what is important, what tools we are green lighting or what adoption we want people to do. And the thing is that the reality for the recent AI transformation is it's never done. The steady state, we don't know the steady state right now. And so we need to be more transparent about it. At the same time, we can't wait for the steady state to happen. We've missed the boat at that time. So the true AI transformation requires that permanent shift in organization agility, moving away from a destination mindset to a continuous journey. Like teach a person to fish and you feed them for a lifetime. That could never be more true in this particular situation. So how are leaders being more explicit about this communication of change? What is unknown, being transparent about that, giving that safety net and psychological safety to people? At the same time, knowing what is there. Like last year at SmithRx, we had GitHub Copilot. And so we set that as the clear goal that, hey, we want to drive 100% adoption with GitHub Copilot. We had kind of, you know, every all hands, we would talk about it. We had a Q2 brown bags, like we have every week brown bags. We focused that around, you know, what are each one coming and showcasing how they are using it. So how do you equip people with that information and making that more as a implicit motivating factor? Engineers, when they hear others, oh, this saved them, you know, 1 month of time. The estimates came in. Like during that time, no one was ever hearing estimates coming in. And so it automatically becomes engaging. And so how do you kind of create these opportunities and environments to foster this? So I think communication is one of the key thing for leaders to, you know, leverage and bring clarity and take the groups along. We also did around communications. We also had each manager in their team meetings. The first 5 minutes is talking about AI, right? What are they using? How is it helping? What are the bottlenecks now? Are the PR volumes such that now people are getting bogged down by PRs? Or is the release becoming slowed down? So what is working? What is not working? And being transparent about that. So creating these opportunities to have clarity, to provide this training becomes super helpful.
So along those lines, what I'm hearing from what you did within your organization is you've obviously changed the communication pattern and you made AI central to how each of, if I hear this correctly, each of the existing sub-organizations worked. So there was not any rearranging of who had what responsibilities. There was no changes in team sizes, et cetera. It was simply a communication change.
I think that is one aspect to it, Bill. There's multiple layers to it.
It's an onion. You got to peel the layers.
Exactly. I think communication is the first layer. The second one is, and before I go into kind of, you know, the pieces of equipping people with the right tooling, the quote that the story that comes to my mind is like, you know, the sharpening your axe, like the two lumberjack people, where one was constantly going on using their axe and working through versus the second one would take breaks. And the second one was more productive. And the first one is saying, hey, well, how come you're more productive? And the person is like, I used to take the breaks to sharpen my axe. And that is so true in today's day and age where things are changing. How are we making sure that you know, the teams are sharpening their axe. They now have to learn how to use agentic in a wise way. What patterns are working? They have to go and still do pair programming, but in the context of shadowing other SMEs who figured out what's working and what's not working. And so I think that investment is very critical, and it's inversely proportional to what people were doing before because of the things that are changing. So, Bill, to your point, I think the second one is how do we create these pods or these environments and situations? And as leaders, you have to measure what is important. So earlier, we would measure shadows, right? We wanted to empower our people to go and understand the customers. So we would make sure that people are doing shadows, you know, frequently, repeatedly, etc. Now that shadows is with other SMEs to learn, or even industry experts to learn and bring that knowledge back over here. So I think the second piece is how are we making sure people are upping their craft, upping their skill levels, and amping up themselves. To Alex's point, the individual productivity needs all of these things put together. And I'll peel the onion on the third one, which is kind of the tooling aspect, but I'll pause and see if that makes sense, Bill, to what you were mentioning.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. It's counterintuitive in some levels to what I was expecting, just because you're looking at how the changes are in the market today. And to put it kindly, there are large shifts in the organization from the standpoint of human resources. Let's just put it that way. And a lot of companies have modified their behavior as a result of that. So to hear that you basically took the existing company and say, this is a tool, which I fundamentally believe, this is a tool to help people who write code and do other things do it better, do it faster, do all sorts of things with it, and not to replace them. And I think you guys have really, really lined that up well. So that's it's refreshing and, to be honest, a little bit surprising.
Let me actually put a little bit of a finer point on that question, because
the finer point.
Yeah, I like the mix that Alex is making.
Well, I think what's interesting about this is, you know, obviously there's different ways to kind of come at this, and I think what Bill was weirdly cryptic about is some people use AI as an opportunity to get rid of people because they've overhired or whatever, and they're like, what a great opportunity to clear house, right? Let's set those people aside. That's not interesting, frankly, or relevant to this discussion. What's interesting is you don't want to get rid of anybody, and you have kind of two options. Option one is you leave things alone, job responsibilities, lines of communication, organizational structure, and then you say, I'm going to just imbue all of this with AI, and my kind of expectation and hope is that everybody gets overall individually more productive and the whole thing just becomes more productive and you get like a better throughput or whatever. The other way to look at this is to say, you know, in making individuals more productive isn't ultimately going to get us there. We need to redesign our work. We need to say jobs have to change. Maybe people have to change. Maybe not. I don't, you know, it's like maybe you keep the role but change the face. I don't know what that looks like,
yeah.
But where do you land on that?
I think those pieces will happen. To what extent and where, that depends on the company. And the parallel that I see is, this is way back in time. Remember when the products were shipped on CDs and all, you had like 2 or 3 years life cycle for software releases. So the organizations would be stuck in that particular fashion for that period. Then when we started to get to releases monthly or, you know, more frequently, et cetera, this is kind of, I'm taking a parallel from a large company like Microsoft and all, right? We saw that the things shifted. We did not have organizations staying static for 2 years of time. We needed to be nimble and shift that based on what is needed for the plan. So it's like, if your planning cycle kind of aligns with your organizational things, because you need to align them. Otherwise, you're going to not have that parity. And I think that is the similar pattern, Alex, that's happening right now, where yes, you will see the shift happen. But there are a couple of things that need to be in place for that shift to happen. So let me, like, we talked a little bit about individual productivity. But in order for that individual productivity to be unlocked, the environment, the tooling, the processes need to be evolved as well. You cannot keep those static. By that, what I mean is, think of the operating system of a company. That becomes really critical, and there are companies and leaders who have been intentional about it and intentional about investing in it. And there are some companies who are like, you know what, it will take its shape as and when whatever is needed. Like, you know, it's fine. But for people which have intentionally done, you can see the where they are adopters quickly. You can see them being more efficient. You can see their teams being more empowered. And that is what is important. So in this AI shift, that operating system, investing in your tooling, in your processes, becomes very important. So what does that look like in today's day and age? Like, we are piloting a software builder role, right? Where you have PM, design, and eng, kind of each kind of the person doing it together. And that way we are doing it across three teams so that we can understand what is working, what is not working. Because I really believe that down the line, you're not just going to have one model. Like, when I say one model, is one organizational blueprint kind of. There's going to be these full stack software builders kind of. There will be, for more complex cases, kind of, you know, a pod across different functions, kind of, you know, a builder who is expert in product side, a builder who is expert on system side, kind of fused together. And some could be kind of smaller pods working on a bigger charter or so. So your company needs to kind of understand some of these, have these different rubrics in place based on the project, based on the person to be able to facilitate this. So that's one thing around the organizational pieces. The second piece is around the actual communication flow. So by that, what I mean is, if you look at managers, right? Traditionally, the manager's role was, you know, ensuring that, you know, what's happening across their team, relay that context up and down. And companies move fast or slow based on this information flow. So companies that have, you know, instrumented this tooling for this ease of communication flow can have managers delegate that such that they can also now contribute towards coding and towards product building. And so to Bill's point, yes, the organizations will get efficient, but if the company OS was not, you know, strong fundamentally, you cannot go and drive those efficiencies. Like, if a leader just says, okay, you know what, company ABC, remove this layers, I'm going to remove it for my team. But if they don't have that glue to make the information flow, if the manager was doing that, and if you remove the manager, things are going to fall apart. So leaders need to understand where and how to go on fine-tuning to drive the efficiency. And to your point, we, on our side, we wanted to have, you know, information connected through Salesforce, Jira, et cetera, to have that, you know, company OS agent kind of, to be able to, you know, have leaders and managers and ICs have that shared knowledge. But to your point, we are a healthcare company. We need to make sure that all the compliance and everything is clear so that we can then go ahead. And so to some point, you will have to make sure that you're bringing all these people in at the right timing to avoid serialization.
So, yeah, this is really interesting. Actually, I picked up a couple of themes there, and I want to kind of get into them. And one thing I heard pretty loud and clear from what you've been describing is, you know, we're all undergoing this like redefinition of roles, because AI, one of my favorite sayings recently has been, AI makes it possible for you to do everybody else's jobs poorly, right? Which is true, but it also means you can do somebody else's job that you couldn't before. And so, yes, you have situations where an engineer can now write the specs, a PM can now vibe code or agentic code a PR, and on and on and on, right? There's this stuff is both. So it sounds like what you guys are, you've sort of acknowledged that that's a reality. And then specifically when to do what, when do you decide to do somebody else's job is very contextual to the thing you're doing, the size of the project, the scope of the work or what have you, right? Totally makes sense. I guess I'm very curious. Have you found like good heuristics around that? What's the right, when is it like, you know, there's some obvious stuff, right? If it's a small bug that you could just explore with Claude and produce a PR for as a PM, you should just do that. If it's some internal tool that, you know, you don't need to get too precious about the requirements, let the developer kind of take a shot at first interactive prototype with Claude because design's really great and, you know, it'll sort a lot of stuff out. Do you have heuristics about like what's the right, when to do what?
Yeah. So I think there are a couple of things that we have seen. One is, and this is true for us because of kind of the complexity of healthcare and the workflows that are cross-cutting. So having PMs kind of figure out that high-level workflow helps to understand the end-to-end. And then having these teams do take on more specific, deeper requirements, that is tying it back to the workflow. So that helps to not have to have that many more PMs. The PMs can go more broader and engineers or so can go depth. So this is the model in which, like, you know, we have engineers and PMs outside of the full software builder piece. Now, in cases where we know that, okay, this is a full area, a software builder can go and tackle that. So for example, if we have an enterprise use case that is coming through, that one can go deeper. So it's kind of a well-understood scenario that needs to be thought through. A software builder can take that and run with it end-to-end. So there are different aspects where, you know, the PMs can, you know, focus more on breadth. But there are also cases where PMs are going and doing the deeper requirements. They are going one step further, which is the prototype. Because earlier, that would take a longer time. And sometimes we would skip that step, right? Because in order to go fast, we are like, okay, let's just go build it. We have confidence or so. But now with this, the PMs have the flexibility to go and validate that more with the customer. So having that more prototype and having them build it is much more better. And it's actually making it more feasible for different teams to understand what is being required. But I will mention one thing, Alex, which goes back to the nature of change, right? And this is human nature, where we get into so much of this habit and bias of doing things a certain way that needs to be rethinked. I had two cases where we had the team kind of come and review their proposal. We were kind of having a mobile app. And in both those cases, some of the AI capabilities, the team had it in version two instead of version in phase two instead of phase one. And I'm like, why? Why not just go with phase one? When you're building a mobile app, why can't we rethink it from the chat as the first aspect of your AI assistant right there in the mobile app? And that way, you don't even need to have some of the screens in phase one because you're getting the capabilities answered. So it was, you could see that people were not thinking about it that way. They were still going with, I'll build it the way I'm used to building it. Phase two, I will build AI as the nice to have feature. And that goes back to that human shift of reminding people and giving them that courage that think differently. You can do now things in a different way than just optimizing it small. And same way, when you're automating some workflow, there's one step of, oh, you're now wiring all this together. But you might not even need all this wiring. If you rethink it, you can now just jump from first step to the next step. So kind of giving that boost to people and that confidence and jiggering that it's okay, think differently.
Along those lines, it actually sounds like from the communication perspective, a large portion of it is to empower the teams to be more autonomous and to be bolder, for lack of a better term, but also at the corporate level, really to focus on the coordination to, as these teams become more independent and start doing things, the coordination, as they churn things out more quickly, the coordination level gets more and more intense.
Yes. And that's exactly where, you know, there are two ways to scale the coordination. You put more managers and human people, or you make the system stronger with the information flow and kind of, you know, more standardizations that can help people to, you know, scale that. And that's kind of where the goes back to our first point on investment on, do we have the right levers in the operating system of the company for communication, for planning, for execution, as well as the tooling, right? The investment that is needed for SDLC to now adapt to the high rate of changes that are going through it, for, you know, our data layers to become much more stronger now so that we have the right data insights being generated by AI that is sitting on top of it. So I think the investment on these things will become a must-have compared to a nice-to-have in the phase where the velocity and productivity is relying on it.
Yeah, and I would assume the discipline of actually using it is becoming much more important, which sounds like a small piece, but in reality, as we all know, that sometimes the tools aren't used as intended or as often as intended.
So let me actually get into the other part of this. So we talked a lot about adoption, and you know, you've made excellent points on both what that looks like and also the investment that it takes. And so naturally, right, when you talk about this is requiring a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get going, the question is, to what end? What's it actually impacting? You know, and I'll just, you hear story after story about Uber CEO, you know, announces a few days ago that they burned through a year's worth of AI allocation in like 3 months. Microsoft, one of the richest companies in the world, is, you know, declaring that it's too cost prohibitive for their employees to use Claude Code. Salesforce somehow spends $300 million on AI in a year. So there's all these things happening. And my question, and I'm very curious to hear if you've seen this sort of in the wild, have there actually been meaningful value impacts of ROI on ROI of all this? Did revenue go up anywhere? Did cost come down anywhere? You know, just talk a little about that.
Totally. And I think that's definitely the case. I'll tell you both from qualitative perspective as well as quantitative perspective, right? Just from qualitative perspective, last year, we had additional things that came up. One was one of our critical projects. We saw more unexpected use cases that surfaced. We had a third-party dependency that went down. So we had to, you know, absorb that and have workarounds, et cetera. So basically, we had additional work on top of what was already on the roadmap. And we were able to absorb that. And one of the big reasons was because people were using AI tooling for their productivity. And we saw that helped significantly. So that was one kind of just the qualitative aspect. The quantitative aspect of it is we have seen where one of our AI assistants, we had kind of a case study. And before, when we were doing it, this was more in kind of 2024 timeframe, it took around 3 people 1 quarter. And then when we did it around late 2025, early 2026, we saw 1 person do it in 1 quarter. So we have definitely seen the productivity gains from it for engineering capacity. The second piece is around just the power users, right? Where you have 90%, 80 to 90% in one or two SMEs that we have seen who have multiple projects and agents going on and being productive. And so now the thing is, how do we bring that? It's not just become an AI, use your AI adoption and AI tooling, but how do we drive that productivity for you know more of our employees? So that's kind of one thing on just the engineering productivity. But I want to give you another outlook around just the AI in the product, right? And how it impacts the end user who is using our product capabilities. So we have AI assistants that enable our customer support, our clinical teams to simplify, like they have to have three or four different tools to make sense when a customer is talking or when they're kind of going through prior auth, et cetera. And so having that AI assistant made it like we started to see 21% efficiency in their call duration or the task duration. So we were able to measure that and see how that can impact the resourcing for that particular organization. And that is just kind of first one step into it. The second aspect is we were then able to see that some of the recommendations we were doing with prior auth, we were able to then say, okay, these four or five ones seem fairly deterministic. And we could just do the agentic AI workflow, connecting with different tools for different approvals automatically, and you know reduce the turnaround even further. And so basically taking that phases of measuring, getting confidence, seeing it work, and kind of peeling the onion further. It was funny, we did a kind of, it wasn't complete, but we had the most of the prototype and the pieces in a working state where our claim benefits, we do kind of SmithRx's pharmacy benefits management. So we have to author a benefit plans, et cetera. And we showcased it to some of the stakeholders where, you know, they had to manually kind of build out those plans and test it, which would take days. And with some of the pieces that we built, they would be able to do it in hours. And they were like so excited. They were like, oh, this is like Steph Curry or Michael Jordan level for them. So we are definitely seeing, you know, impact from these both for our internal tech teams as well as the end users that we build the product for.
Yeah, no, then that's awesome to hear. And, you know, I obviously realize that there's a lot of companies that are getting a lot of value out of this, but I think it's always good to have not necessarily a skeptical, but sort of a realistic outlook on how much impact are you actually going to get. And so, you know, I do think marginal is probably realistic, not kind of orders of magnitude foundational, because it's hard to pull off as you get larger. Let me ask you one more question, and I'm curious. So it sounds like things have gone really well, and you've got the adoption, you've got the impact. Is there, and you've mentioned culture so much already, and I just want to really zoom in on that. What's specifically special about the culture within your organization or anywhere else you've seen this work that like is notable, and others can try to maybe not copy, because that's hard to do. Culture is notoriously difficult to copy and paste. But, you know, take inspiration from. Culturally, what does it look like to have a AI impactful organization?
Yeah, I think it is definitely a couple of things that I would see. One is just the ownership mindset, right? Where people are not waiting for what to be done, but they're proactively, you know, owning the outcomes and all. And I understand in larger companies or companies with more kind of compliance and rigor, it means that the person cannot just go off and use any tool which is not sanctioned. That's different. Over there, they can still come up and say that, hey, this tool is proper for my areas and I need to see how we can get it into the mainstream. But the overall mindset of ownership and being curious, being learners, going out and seeking, that is so, so essential. I have seen, you know, and we all have seen, right? We see different spectrum of people. there are employees who are innovators and SMEs. Like, you know, they're like, tell me more. I'm ready to try this out. And as leaders, how do you champion those to pilot and try things out? And there are the other extreme who are like, they're sand in, yeah, their head in the sand like an ostrich and like, this is not happening to me. It's happening to someone else, kind of, right? They are not like, you're equipping them, but they're not ready to change. They're not going to survive, right? And this middle people, which is like, I'm ready, but I don't know how to do, what to do. So you coach them, you equip them, but kind of that having that sense of curiosity, that self-starter, that, you know, ability to change and up their skill sets, learn, be ready for change is very, very key. And for that, that ownership and curious mindset and creating those opportunities and bringing more visibility and kind of, you know, recognizing and rewarding those kind of people will be super, super helpful. So I think that's one aspect of skill sets that's super important is having the ability to be curious and owning. The second one is also around, the overall communication. I can't stress enough on communication because if you look at, you know, the skills of a manager or engineer or so, what differentiated some of the fast velocity career, high career trajectory people was they were able to understand the business. They were able to translate how technology and business tie together. They were able to articulate the problem so that people could understand. And now that has become a norm. If people are not able to do that, it's a survival crisis. So kind of, you know, bringing that importance of, you know, communication, the business, the understanding of the end customer, what is the KPIs and objective that's important, like showing that impact and vision so that people can now be empowered to try and ideate towards it rather than waiting to be told. So how do you create that environment? And for that, again, it goes back to the operating system. How do you make data accessible for people to do the insights, or how do you, you know, make it accessible for people to shadow and understand the customer problems and understand the business KPIs?
Yeah, on some levels, it sounds like you're building something of a ideological incubator. You're creating a framework for teams to be autonomous, but the support structure for them to be that and to take risks and to lean on others for help and to get continuous communication about how to do things, what's right, what's new, what to avoid, et cetera, and coordinating things from a perspective of someone who has a larger context view. And to me, that sounds very much like an incubator.
The other thing that struck me...
Go ahead, Alex.
Oh, go ahead. No, please go ahead.
I think, Bill, that's so true. Like, that is what is going to be the rubric until we reach the next steady state or so. Because I remember the podcast you guys did with both of you on engineering practices, right? How that's changing. Like, literally, every aspect of, it's not just the role, every aspect of the function that is being done in software lifecycle, whether it's agent, whether it's engineer, whether it's PM, design, every aspect of that is evolving. Yes, the first principles will remain true, but that's evolving. And the only way to go and adopt that faster and ideate is we need people on the ground to champion that and not wait for the leader to go and say, hey, this is broken. Someone put light on it. No, we need people on the ground to say, hey, I see this. I think I know what I'll do. I'll try this out. I'll ideate. If it fails, it fails. I tried it. And that is the kind of mindset we need.
Yes, and that's the one thing, the common thread that I've picked up since the beginning of this conversation is that you're providing an environment where it's safe to try.
Totally. Alex, and you were going to
say that. That is not common, at least in smaller organizations, I can tell you.
But what's interesting about that, as you're describing this like ideal person that really can do well in this environment, that sounds a lot like people who work at startups. A self-starter, go-getter who knows they have to be responsible for stuff because there's nobody next to them to take over and do their job for them. That's startup people. Like, that's who you want to hire when you're tiny and are trying to survive. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to be kind of, I don't want to dismiss larger companies, but like the reality is the talent mix in a larger company doesn't look like that of a startup usually, right? It's people who are less comfortable with high velocity of change, less of a self-starter, not for any bad character flaw reason, but just that's why they're a large company. They were, you know, attracted to that stable environment where they don't have to necessarily fight the battles every waking hour. They could just do a thing and have a life. And so that's actually one of the, kind of in my mind, one of the key issues here. It's like you want a large company to act like a startup because the kinds of people who do this well are startup people, but they're not.
But I think this is exactly where, Alex, you hit the nail there, right? If you look at some of the companies who are able to shift faster and adopt faster is because they have this ingrained into their bigger company operating system model as well. Is the sense of ownership, is the sense of agility and trying things out. And I really believe that, and that's the reason why even in bigger companies, why they want that smaller kind of incubation teams or pilot teams so that they can do this and have that pattern that others can drive adoption for. And that's kind of where, you know, how do you make that conversation? How do you provide that tooling? But at the same time, each team and each smaller group needs to not wait for the bigger thing. They need to be that, you know, trailblazer. And to Bill's point, yes, everyone might not be, but I really believe that if the bigger organization, you break it in smaller. So in those smaller groups, you still need this pattern where you have the SMEs or innovators trailblazing, trying things out, bringing adoption, bringing that and empowering the rest of the organization. And as leaders, you need to continue seeking those out, investing in them, making sure they get that space to try things out and, you know, fail fast so that others are not repeating the same things at least. And then follow that norm. So yes, it's easier probably in startup. We need that similar kind of rubric in a bigger context, whether it's mid companies or larger companies, to apply that pattern in the context that's still workable while keeping the bigger norms in place.
Yes, absolutely. Well, on that note, this has been a wonderful discussion. We really appreciate your time and we really appreciate you being here today.
Yes, very much.
Same here, Alex and Bill. It's always amazing to hear all the insights and, you know, shifts that we are seeing and learning from each other's patterns. So thank you for making this happen.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, if you found this topic or topics like this one interesting or relevant to you, LA CTO Forum has lots of opportunities to engage with other CTOs about things just like this one. If you're interested in learning more, find us on LinkedIn or on the web at lactoforum.org. And until next time, may your deployments be smooth and your tech debt manageable.
And remember, if you can't handle the exception, at least log it properly. We'll catch you next time.